And I'm going to end this show. Y'all have a blessed Sunday. I will see you not next week, but the week after next. Jerry Silva will be coming in next Sunday. So y'all have a blessed one. I'm out of here.
I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things.
Join me every Sunday night at 8 p.m. for Dark Star Dead and Music, the best in Grateful Dead music and beyond. This is your host, Arnella Barbara, Dark Star Girl at KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Good morning. You're tuned into 90.7 KPFK Los Angeles. Up next, you have Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. The show recorded up next was before Trump bombed Iran's nuclear sites. The interview you are about to hear analyzes the dangers of the escalation in an already volatile situation. 90.7 KPFK, Beneath the Surface.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Yasemin Mather joins us today with her analysis of Israel's Operation Rising Lion, a unilateral military strike on Iran and a dangerous escalation in an already volatile region. This comes as Israel continues its genocidal war on Gaza, accelerates the dispossession of Palestinians in the West Bank, has committed acts of terror in Lebanon with the pager bombs and land grabs in Syria following the collapse of the Assad regime. Netanyahu's war cabinet is pursuing military solutions on all fronts. And now, Iran. The strike caught Tehran by surprise. While the regime insists it's victorious, its nuclear and energy infrastructure has been hit. And for the first time, Iran is retaliating deep inside Israeli territory. Although the U.S. was fully informed of Israel's intentions, Netanyahu disregarded Trump's public opposition to the strike. But now Trump endorses Netanyahu's attack and warns Iran to make a deal or else. The attack comes just as diplomatic efforts over Iran's nuclear program were reportedly gaining traction. Was Israel trying to sabotage diplomacy? Was this also a way to deflect attention from the carnage in Gaza and Israel's failure to rescue the hostages after more than 20 months of genocidal violence? Does the timing of Israel's attack also suggest that the Netanyahu government opposes any peaceful settlement or so-called normalization of relations with Iran? Beneath Israel's bombs lies a deeply unpopular and repressive Iranian regime, one that has spent heavily projecting the Islamic Revolution abroad while presiding over economic ruin and paralysis at home. But it's also true that Israel, once the West's so-called only democracy in the Middle East, is fast becoming a pariah state, waging war with impunity. And it's something of an irony that Iran, a pariah state for more than 45 years, is now attacked by Israel, whose destruction and starvation of Gazans, political assassinations, and military strikes are turning it into an international outlier. Well, to help us understand all of this, I'm joined by Yasemin Mather, a longtime socialist, critic of the Islamic Republic, U.S. interventions in the region, and a sharp, principled voice on Middle East politics. All of this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to the program, Yasemin. I'm really pleased to have you here and can't wait to hear your analysis. Yasemin Mather is an Iranian scholar and a political activist. She's the acting editor of Critique, a journal of socialist theory, and I am also on that editorial board. Her research on Iran is within the framework of the Middle East Center at the University of Oxford, where she also works as a scientific developer in the Advanced Research Computing Department. Yasmin writes regularly on Iran and the Middle East and often participates in debates broadcast by BBC Persian service. Her article, The Political Economy of Iran's Islamic State, Donald Trump and the Threats of War, appeared in Critique in 2018. And she is the chair of the Hands Off the People of Iran, or HOPI. So with all of that, Yasmin, you've written that people in Iranian cities and in Israel have faced indiscriminate bombing and drone attacks, noting that Israelis have sirens and bomb shelters, but there is no warning in Iran. Civilians, including nuclear scientists and military officers, have been assassinated in their homes with collateral damage to residents in the area. Trump's openly threatened the assassination of Iran's head of state, all while Israel carries out mass starvation in Gaza. And that's the backdrop. So let's begin with what has transpired since Israel launched this operation on June 13th. What do we know so far?
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's very difficult to know exactly how much the United States and Trump in particular encouraged the Israelis to do this attack and how many differences there existed between the two. The reason I'm saying this is that on the one hand, you are absolutely right that discussions were going on with Iran in Oman, with Witkoff, and then we had almost a sudden break of those as the sixth meeting was being planned. And of course, Netanyahu's reasons were obvious. He wanted to divert attention from pressures in Europe, where some of the European countries, including the United Kingdom, were giving statements, but also passing resolutions of sanctions against individual members of his government. So from Netanyahu's point of view, it's very clear why he definitely needed this. But was it also the 61st day after Trump had given a warning of 60 days? We don't know, because his statements on the subject are so confusing, I don't even want to go there. One thing is clear, as much as the Iranian government is not telling us the truth about what was going on in these secret talks in Oman, five rounds of which happened between Witkoff and Iran's foreign minister, we can't believe what the United States is saying either. On the one hand, the United States claims that zero enrichment was their position. On the other hand, we hear reasonably reliable information from various people involved in these discussions, including non-Iranians, that percentages of enrichment were being discussed. So I'm completely confused as to where we were before these talks broke down in terms of enrichment. Were we on 0%, as Trump keeps telling us? Was Witkoff giving other information? And then we have the debate, which is now quite strong in Iran. Was the U.S. administration deceiving the Iranians into a false sense of security while all the time they were preparing or talking to Israel about an imminent attack? The reality is what happened. So in some ways, although some of these questions are important, they don't have much consequences, because the consequence is quite clear. We face this attack. I would add just one point in terms of this first bombing of Friday last week and events in the last few days. It is true that the G7 summit in Alberta passed a resolution basically not saying much, but definitely not condemning Israel, as was the request of the Trump administration. But the tone of the European statements is milder in terms of attacking Iran. had it not been for Gaza, had it not been for the fact that very little and very late, but some of these governments, especially in France and in Britain, are very concerned about what is happening in Gaza. There are two interpretations of this. I don't think they are worried about the humanitarian aspects of starving a whole population to death. They didn't say much when tens of thousands were being killed. I think there is an apprehension about the consequences of what is going on in Gaza, the possibility that maybe not now, but at some stage there will be trials. And some of these people are astute enough to want to put some distance between themselves and the Israeli premier. Having said that, I can't imagine the Iranian government or the Islamic regime gaining any support from the Europeans. The fact that they actually went to talk to Iran's foreign minister today shows it's likely less antagonistic than had it not been for the horror that some of these leaders feel about events in Gaza.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack, Yasmin, but I wanted to just go back because you started to talk about the confusion about Iran's nuclear program and how much it really has. I think the IAEA says Iran has enriched uranium to only 60%, which is not weapons grade. And of course, Israel has launched this attack, and we have to say this has been Netanyahu's obsession for decades, at least. And there is a certain level of hypocrisy there because Israel is a nuclear power and clearly wants to be not only the only nuclear power in the region, but also the only country that has the scientific expertise to move on nuclear power. We're not talking even nuclear war there. So there's that. And then on the other hand, and you suggested this, and there's an article by Jamal Khanj who calls this strike on June 13th and the subsequent war, a preemptive strike on diplomacy. And so, as you've suggested, there were these secret talks in Oman, and Trump has repeatedly, and I think we should say, maybe you can elaborate further on whether or not Trump was quietly encouraging this. Trump doesn't like war, you know, and so I think that his first, and often Trump, you know, is a well-known pathological liar, but he often blurts out the truth. And so you have to be there to kind of understand it. And when he said that he publicly condemned Israel's strike, he showed that he knew about it, but on the other hand, tried to oppose it. And Israel went ahead and did it against Trump, perhaps, you know, showing, I guess, the level either of Netanyahu's arrogance or that, as you hinted, he may have had some quiet encouragement. So I guess there's a lot there to discuss. So let's just talk about, I guess, that what's really happening here and what's at stake. And also just a little bit about, you know, the possibility of diplomacy and what Israel is actually hitting inside Iran.
You've raised some very important questions. I mean, I think 20 years ago, Israel and Netanyahu, when he was in power, but also when he was in opposition, was saying Iran is a few years away from a nuclear weapon. And in the last 10 years, every time he's talked, he's saying it's imminent, they've got it, they're nearly getting it. The reality is that as far as I can tell, and again, I'm not privy to the secrets of the Islamic Republic, but from what I can tell and what IAEA is telling us, Iran is very close to a level where it can promote enrichment to the 90% level, which you rightly pointed out is weapons-grade uranium, but it has stopped there, right? And this has been going on for a while. Now, the agreement made in 2015 that later Trump walked out of, JCPOA, was really limiting Iran to 3.67, if I'm not mistaken, of uranium enrichment. And that is still what is being discussed. So we're talking of 4 rather than 3, 6, 7. This doesn't go with the 60%, but you can match them to that. So this is where we are. And I think this, I mean, some of the press here talks about existential threat of a nuclear bomb in Iran. I think Israel really needs to destroy Iran. Now, there are very few, but very limited sections of Iranian royalists who actually believe that Netanyahu wants to create democracy in Iran. And the obvious question is, well, maybe he should start with democracy in his own country, where he continues war in order not to have an election. But also, we are talking of a country where the Arab population of the Israeli citizens of Arab origin don't have basic rights, all sorts of other issues. So it's not about democracy in Iran. And I don't really think it's about a bomb either. I don't think anyone in their right mind would believe that suddenly, within days or weeks, whichever you take, there'll be a bomb in Tehran. More importantly, if Iran did enrich uranium to that level, it has no means of delivering it. My understanding is that the Jericho 2-3 program in Israel have missiles that are very good at delivering Israel's nuclear weapons, but also there is a whole submarine program that helps Israel prepare for delivery on international waters near an enemy country. Iran is not in that position. Iran has no missiles that can, if you like, deliver. It has other types of missiles, but not missiles that can take a nuclear bomb. And so it really is very difficult to see the rationale, except in terms of diverting attention from Gaza. And as you rightly pointed out, not wanting a country of 90 million, it's quite a huge country, Iran, yeah, compared to what, 8-9 million Israelis in the region, where if, for example, the sanctions didn't exist, if Iran wasn't dominated by a clerical regime that is corrupt and causes all sorts of other problems, we are looking at a young country with great capabilities in terms of internet knowledge, computing knowledge, artificial intelligence knowledge. So if those capabilities were not drained by both sanctions, but also a government that diverts the existing talent towards military structures, then Israel will have a competitor it can't even imagine to compete with. And so division of Iran, if you like, disturbing the current borders of the country, encouraging separatist movements in order to divide the country into at least 4 countries, would be extremely good for Israel, because once and for all, the problem Iran will disappear. And the United States, under both Democrats and Republicans, I'm sure would welcome that. The issue will be resolved once and for all.
Can you just elaborate on that? Because, well, I was going to say, I wanted to lead on to both the backlash and the, you know, nationalism of a giant country like Iran that is very nationalistic and has, as you said, a young population, although they are getting older. But you just said that about the possibility or having a plan of dividing it into 4 different kinds of countries. That was Biden's plan in Iraq, if you remember. And it was rightly condemned as an outside imposition from someone who doesn't really know the history. Are you suggesting that, I mean, who are you suggesting is proposing this and along what lines?
Okay, so basically, Israel has supported parts of the Kurdish separatist movement, not all of it, because quite a few of them don't support that. But as you know, the Israeli influence in Iraqi Kurdistan existed, and then it sections of the Iranian Kurdistan. This is not the Kurdish movement in Iran. It's very small, it's part of it. The problem is that when you're sitting in Tel Aviv and you look at these opposition groups, both for your own propaganda, but also because you're spending money on them, it is good to exaggerate their influence, exaggerate how powerful they are. And sometimes this has this dual effect that you both believe the propaganda you've been spreading. Mm-hmm. Right. And now we are in a situation where I think Netanyahu did really, I don't know, I mean, some people are saying I'm wrong, but I think Netanyahu did really believe that the royalists he's been paying and Mossad has been grooming for at least a decade with TV stations, financial support, and so on, have so much support that a few bombs will be enough for them to overthrow the Islamic Republic.
This is really interesting because basically you're saying that Israel itself is operating on, perhaps like Putin did, thinking he could just have a three-day blitz and it would be over and Ukraine would surrender. So let's go there, because Israel, both Netanyahu and Trump, have been promoting regime change. Underlying that is an assessment of the weakness of the Iranian regime. You've said that this is crazy, but let's just go there. And also, perhaps if you could bring in how many people have now been killed, how many have been displaced, what Israel is doing beyond these so-called nuclear sites, bombing gas and oil and other things. Just give us a sort of wider sense.
Sure. Okay, I think that there was an impression that things will change in a few days, not the first bombing, but in a few days. Now, this is, first of all, underestimating how a regime like the Islamic Republic operates, because it has both its devotees who are religious and therefore supported, but it's also got people whose financial livelihood depends on this state. And so they will try and support it, at least in the short run. Right? The problem is that the royalists on the ground seem to be far weaker than even what I thought. I always thought they were exaggerated, there was too much propaganda, this wasn't as many as people thought. But the reality is that I haven't seen a single demonstration of even 10 people defending Israel's action and raising the royalist flag. And you understand that exactly by the questions you asked later. So, the population of Tehran, 9 million, were told, Tehran has more, I think it's about 15, 16 million, but let's say the central bit, which is 9 million, Trump, if you remember, told people to leave the capital. Now, this is not a capital where 9 million can live. Where would they go? So those who could afford, those who had cars, those who had second homes in the Caspian Sea, did leave, and there were traffic jams. All this week, we've been hearing about traffic jams leaving Tehran. But nobody went to a demonstration in the middle of Tehran saying, long live Israel for attacking us. People were leaving their homes. They were leaving relatives. So they were quite upset. And everyone who was, until the internet was stopped yesterday, and again, we don't know if it's infrastructure that stopped the internet, the state opposed it, stopped it, or whatever. But until we had internet, everyone who was leaving was very angry with Israel. And it's inevitable. You're destroying their homes. Up to yesterday, I was hearing 520 dead. And okay, the first night we were talking,
I think I heard today, by the way, 625.
That would be right, because the figure I'm giving is old, and it always goes up because people are dying in hospitals as well and so on. Yeah. So we had a situation where drones destroyed blocks of flats, but of course you can't destroy a single room. So where these physicists were killed, their neighbors might not even know who these people were. Ordinary people were living above and below these flats, and they were all killed. And since then, there has been a lot more. I mean, the Iranian government is obviously showing pictures of children, women, and so on. And of course, that's true. But it's also that some of these people were relatives of Revolutionary Guards or physicists. The idea is that, if you like, you start bombing people and they support you is unlikely. If you remember in 2003, there were moments when the US Army actually entered Iraq where people started changing their positions. But until boots on the ground entered Baghdad, no one was shouting against Saddam Hussein. There's an element of fear, but there's also an element of, this is my country. In Iran, it's slightly different. I think people underestimate, and everyone does that, and Saddam did underestimate it. There is a sense of nationalism. I thought that would happen, but we're obviously seeing it every day this week. And this is partly culture, poetry, history, often the exaggerated sense of the glorious past, because let's remember, there is no glorious past in any of these countries. Just to give you an example, when I went to school, we didn't read about the Greeks defeating the Persian Empire. We got a very distorted history of that whole period, right? So Darius did, or Xerxes, didn't lose the empire. And this false history of the Persian Empire is reflected in poetry, in nationalist writings by people like Ferdowsi, other writers, and so on. And it goes beyond the Persian nation. So there are Kurds who are, because Kurds have this history, this historic unity with Persians, they speak a dialect of Persian. Kurds feel that nationalism as well, or Iranian Azeris, Azerbaijanis in Iran, they speak Turkish.
But if you ask them, Azeri language also is similar to Persian, is it?
No, it isn't.
It's Turkic.
It's far more Turkic.
Okay.
But although they speak a different language, if you ask them about their history, they will go on about the Persian Empire. Very few of them identify with the Ottoman Empire, which came many centuries later. So in this, you have this bizarre situation where nationalities, although they do want far more rights than either the Pahlavis gave them, the Qajar dynasty gave them, or now the Islamic Republic is giving them, when it comes to a country trying to divide Iran or destroy Iran or Persia, they become nationalist. Now, I'm not necessarily saying this is a great thing, because I think in the long term, the left will also have problems with this deep sense of nationalism. However, it's inevitable that when Israel attacks or when Saddam attacked, this becomes the overwhelming sentiment within the country, and it trumps everything else. Everything else is in the shadow of this nationalism.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And it would be almost anywhere the same case, no matter how much you, and even, you know, for you and I, who are both anti-nationalists, that this is something you just have to recognize, yeah, that a nation under attack arouses the population to support the nation against the attackers. But let's just say a little bit more about that, because you started to talk about, you know, the potted history that you had being educated in Iran. And I wondered how much you think the legacy of, say, U.S. intervention in the coup in 1953 that got rid of Mossadegh and installed the Shah, and then the 1979 Iranian Revolution, and then, of course, the trauma of the Iran-Iraq War, is foremost, or let's say just in the minds of most Iranians who see this new attack as somehow perpetuating or creating yet another legacy of trauma.
It's definitely true that for many of the older generation, especially, necessarily very old, middle-aged people and older, the traumas of 1953 remain quite live in their minds, because for them, this is the only chance the Middle East could have had a democratic government, and it was destroyed by a coup. And then we have 1979. Now here, among sections of the young population, even those who are now opposed to Israeli attack and the royalists, but there is a nostalgia for the Pahlavi era. This is partly because of the relentless propaganda that comes from TV stations, paid by US, paid by Israel, paid by Saudi Arabia, who present that era as, you know, they show women wearing short skirts, going to university, and so on. And of course, going to university, the Islamic Republic has far higher percentage of women going to university. But let us not forget, this is a religious government that has attacked women's rights since the day it came to power. So that nostalgia exists, but it doesn't mean that nostalgia would reflect itself in people becoming royalists. And that, again, is a miscalculation of those who want regime change. You can have nostalgia for some aspects of that period, but then the same young generation on Instagram, on YouTube, sees the other aspects of the Shah's era. The stupidity, for example, of the 2,500-year tent celebrations. I'm sure you hopefully you've forgotten it was a horrible scenario, but he celebrated 2,500 years of Iranian kingdoms in Persepolis, and royalties from all over the world, heads of state went. And it was embarrassing. It was quite an awful thing. But also for a poor country, you know, to have food delivered from Paris for these heads of state, it was just unbelievable. You couldn't imagine a worse thing to do. So this young generation might have nostalgia for aspects of the Shah's era, but they also are, at least the intelligent sections of this young population, is also aware of the negative sides of that era. And I don't think it's as straightforward as saying, okay, we want him back. It's far more complicated. And this complication is something that I don't think Trump talking of regime change or Netanyahu talking of regime change have the capability of understanding.
I think that that's a really important point, Yasmin, that I've asked people around here, younger people, so let's say 20, 30 years younger than me, and they only know, you know, Iran under the mullahs, and have this impression that because, as you just said, women could wear short skirts and go to university. Of course, they're going to university now, too, in larger numbers than men, Tehran University. But even so, there's this sense that under the Shah, things were better. And, you know, I grew up at a time when all we ever heard about was Savak's torture regime.
Absolutely.
You know, and how much we cheered when that regime was overthrown, even though, you know, and I think the left got a lot of it wrong. I remember a headline in like Workers' Vanguard, Mullahs win, as if it was a baseball score, but people mistook what that Iranian revolution meant. But I don't want to go too much into the history. We're talking about now trying to understand the surge of nationalism and why regime change is risky. And I guess you could just say a little bit more. I do want to go on to many other topics here, but just a little bit more about what makes it so risky, thinking about how much Iran has persecuted and crushed any opposition. So if it, you know, were to fall and it is weakened, what would be there to pick up the pieces?
Exactly. And I think even in terms of the nostalgia, we have to blame the Islamic Republic, because here is the remnant of ancien regime with all of its faults coming out of dustbin of history. So who do we blame? The people who have created such a bad situation where these people can exist even, you know, so that's true. But having said that, I'm not 100% sure, but my guess is that the Islamic Republic has many supporters who will fight to the very last breath in their life. It probably has, in the fashion of Hamas, but maybe in a different way, its own underground tunnels, and not just physical tunnels, but ways of infiltrating society. Yeah, they will not go away. They will fight. There is no obvious opposition. I've already said about the royalists. The Mujahideen Khal, supported mainly by some Arab countries, are in a worse state. They helped Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war. I think since then, I have yet to find a single Iranian who actually admits supporting them. Except the people who are in Albania with the leader. But you can't find anyone in your surroundings who might have a good word about them. So we are left then with nationalist groups, the remnants of Tudor, the remnants of the left. But remember that the left has been decimated. I mean, the number of people who've been killed, the number of people forced into exile, the number of people who died in Kurdistan. The regime took its revenge, even failures during the Iran-Iraq war, on the left. It's the left that paid the price for all the defeats of the Islamic Republic. And so we don't have an alternative left waiting to take power. We have the national religious groups. It's very difficult to know whether they would side with the government or with a revolutionary force. I don't think they would definitely side with the left at any stage, even if the left was strong. And you have this layer of ordinary people who might not like the Islamic Republic, but would then say, well, we don't know the alternative. Do we want to become like Libya? And Libya is an example that everyone is talking about. Right. Because a failed state, a corrupt failed state disappearing, will not disappear overnight. You will have infightings. You would have fightings between various factions of the Islamic Republic and those factions with the rest of the population. So it's destruction. We're looking at a very, very bad time, I would imagine.
Let's move to what the possible implications would be if there is this sort of escalation and the U.S. decides to use its bunker buster bombers to take out the nuclear power facilities. What would be the implications? And also, I'd like you to take into consideration what Russia might do, because Putin is failing in Ukraine despite enormous destruction and death. So supporting Iran could give Putin an opening to deflect attention from from Ukraine. And that would, of course, then escalate the possibilities of an all-out war. What are your thoughts about that?
Okay, first on the an attack on the nuclear facility.
Yeah.
That would further weaken the regime. So this regime has said, oh, we are going to defend our independence and so on. So either in talks, if they give up that, or if there is an effective bombing that destroys some of the installation, then that would be considered a defeat and it will weaken the regime. Will it collapse? It's difficult to know. I would say it would continue a process of collapsing, but it won't collapse immediately. And then we have to see, the plan is, if you like, to downgrade Iran, to weaken it, to force it into submission. We don't know. There could be changes within the structures of the Islamic Republic, more hardline revolutionary guards coming to power, or the reformists doing more of a deal with the US. So that's a very difficult situation to predict. In terms of Putin, well, first of all, I heard this from someone, an Iranian, who follows the Russia-Iran relation. This has been a bit of a one-sided relationship in that Iran keeps talking about how Russia is our close ally, is a friend, and so on. And it's in hour of need, not just now, but throughout, say, the last 2 years, Russia hasn't been much of an ally of Iran. And even now, okay, it has made a threat, but I'm not sure how serious that threat is. Remember that Russia, as well as Israel, does not want a very strong Iran. Right. So for Russia as well, there are reasons not to. The $64 million question then is, what would China do on all of this? The sanctions on Iran have been very good for China because Iran can't sell oil to anybody else but China. And it sells very cheap oil to China. And this is one of the problems for Biden, for Trump, for any U.S. administration. They want to stop that cheap oil going from Iran to China. It will affect, it won't be disastrous for China, but it will have some effect. But China doesn't seem to do much either. So you are right. In terms of diverting attention from Ukraine, there are benefits for Russia to at least appear to oppose further attacks on Iran. On the other hand, it's offering its services as a mediator. I think Iran would love Russia to be, because sections of the Iranian government have serious illusions about how Russia will help them. And those of us who try and think a bit more about how opportunist and what a dictator and former KGB man Putin is, and how he's, if you like, the figurehead of a mafia capitalist system, we have no illusions. But I think there are those in the Iranian states that maybe hope there will be something. I can't see either of these two countries, Russia or China, endangering their own interests, never mind their existence, anything in terms of their interest to defend Iran. And they haven't done anything for Gaza. I mean, politically, you would have thought this would be, given the sentiments in Global South, you would have thought it would be at least beneficial to show some practical support instead of occasionally passing resolutions in the UN that are vetoed by US.
Well, I think this is really important because what you've outlined is, on the one hand, the self-interest of these various places like Russia and China and even the United States. And then on the other hand, you have Israel that not only seems to want to permanently degrade Iran's ability to project power, but also to destroy the regime, as we've said, and the implications, or let's say the possibility, is a full-scale war, even though it seems unlikely, and especially a war between nuclear powers. And I tend to think that, you know, rationality will prevail, but it worries me that Israel, Iran, the U.S., and Russia are all led by hardliners who are very, very invested in protecting their own power and extending their own power, and don't care at all about, seemingly, about the death and destruction they leave in their wake. So I guess one question would be, is whether or not you see any diplomatic off-ramp left or possible in this buildup.
I think you are absolutely right that there is a threat of war, global powers confronting each other or threatening each other. But maybe others will stop them. And you're right that all of these countries are led by unbelievably unpredictable and dangerous people. The negotiations have some room. So my limited understanding of these secret talks is that there were bargaining about percentages and so on. Now, Iran is in a difficult position. It's putting a brave face, but my guess is that the Iranian Air Force is at almost at the limit of what it can do. Yes, it can inflict attacks that miss their targets very often or break the Iron Dome occasionally. But we are talking of missiles that cost, the medium-range missiles that Iran is using is costing between $1 to $2 million. Right? In a country facing sanctions, how many did they have? How many have they lost? My guess is they've lost a very large number, both in the bombings of these missile depots, but also in what has been used in the war. So Iran is almost at the limit of what it can do. If it can find a face-saving solution where it says even its, I don't know, 0.5% enrichment is allowed, okay, something that is not zero. And the United States, with Trump saying, I want war. And my understanding is he's coming under pressure from MAGA, who don't want war, as opposed to traditional neoconservative Republicans who do want war.
Exactly.
So if we have all of these factors, there can be a negotiation where everyone finds a face-saving alternative. But the percentage of achieving this, I wouldn't see it being very high. I'm saying it's not impossible. That's best.
Well, no, that's excellent. There's several areas I want to get to before we end today. And one of them is about targeting workers and the class dimension. One of the first airstrikes of Israel hit Tabriz, which is an industrial city with a history of labor unrest and struggle. And you wrote in an article I just read that the first victims will be Iran's working class. What do you mean? And do you see these strikes aimed at political infrastructure as well as, let's call it, the military infrastructure?
Well, the strikes on the tractor factory and Asaluyeh plant in Tabriz were both attacks on infrastructure, but the effect is going to be political in that these workers have a very long tradition of opposition to the Shah's regime, to this regime there. I think some of their history goes back to the 1950s and today, but then other organizations have been active in these factories. So here we are looking at, if you like, attack on the working class that is not going to help the struggles of the working class, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, the destruction of a factory will lead to some of these people, if there is peace, and we don't know, but imagine there is some kind of resolution and there is peace. These people, quite a lot, will have lost their jobs. There is also a lot of attack on Iran's oil installations, depots, refineries set on fire. All of that reduces a working class which was already facing attacks by neoliberal economics in Iran's Islamic Republic. They haven't moved on. They haven't become, they are still in the neoliberal period era because they're always late compared to other capitalist countries. So a very vulnerable working class that was facing job insecurity, low wages, more than a third of population living under poverty line is going to face even more pressures. And as you know, this doesn't mirror in more strikes, more struggles, more workers' protests. On the contrary, it creates a situation where everyone is trying to survive. And in that survival, political struggle is a luxury they can't afford. So, yes, I think it is an attack on the Iranian working class. I have read these leaflets occasionally written by soft left groups saying, oh, this is a war between Iran's Islamic Republic and Zionism and nothing to do with the Iranian people. That's true of many wars. But the reality is that the victims of this war, the people who will suffer most, are not the leaders of the Islamic Republic. It's the ordinary people who've got to leave their homes, who've got to leave their job. I'm not sure what happens to the people who... So this week, the government closed all offices, factories, and so on, in order to allow people to leave without facing penalties, leave major cities. But this can't be sustained for long. And my guess is some of these jobs will disappear. It's a bit like COVID and any other disaster that occurs. At the end of the day, it's the working class who will pay for it.
Let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the implications for what or what might come next. We've talked a bit about, you know, the desires of Israel to inflict regime change, also about the implications for a wider role. But also then, what about the regime itself? Roger Cohen in Friday's New York Times calls Iran a zombie regime, deeply unpopular, slowly collapsing, but still dangerous. The Wall Street Journal on June 20th details how this conflict is rattling the foundations of Iran's theocratic rule and posits whether or not this could lead to collapse or civil war or just more repression. And then on the other hand, and this is something I'd like you to take up, most U.S. action historically against the regime has ended up making it stronger. So does talk of regime change serve both Netanyahu and the Iranian right? And in other words, does Israel's action, rather than further weakening the regime, fortify it? Or do you see it weakened beyond repair?
Because we don't know the true extent of the damage that the state has faced, it's difficult for me to assess this. I would say that the regime is shaken, it's weakened, but not at the level of collapse, not yet anyway. So I would say that's one aspect. I am concerned that, for example, today there were demonstrations after Friday prayers in Tehran, where people were mainly demonstrating against Israel, right, and against the war. But such demonstrations are always used by the Islamic State to beef up its own support and present them as support for the regime as such. And it's very hard, from what I've seen, to distinguish where you draw the line. I would say the majority are angry about the war. At the moment, their attacks are mainly against Israel. But once that issue, one way or another, is resolved, they will show, and if the regime survives, because that's a big if, they will show their anger at the Islamic Republic as well. Because in some ways, they will see that it endangered their livelihood. It endangered their very existence. So there will be both sides of this. In the immediate aftermath of the Israeli attack, I would say the government is benefiting from this, because people are saying, okay, we hate this regime, but we don't want foreigners attacking our country.
Well, Yasmin, you have already talked a little bit about how this regime has crushed dissent and destroyed the left that existed in Iran. But how do you see the international left's response to Israel's attacks so far? I raise this because, as with Russia's war on Ukraine, we see tankies on the anti-imperialist left, those who always see NATO and the U.S. as behind everything that happens in the world, are embracing Iran simply because it opposes the United States and Israel, and ignoring the deeply reactionary Iranian regime's brutality toward its own people, its repression of women, workers, as we've talked about, and critical dissent. So how do you see, I guess, not only what the left has said so far, but what you think it should be doing to express solidarity?
I would imagine that the main task for, say, in Britain or in the US, is to oppose one's own imperialist country without defending anything else, right? So you can defend the Iranian people, and your main target would then be defeatism for the United States and defeatism for UK. That in itself is supporting the Iranian people without falling into the trap that the enemy of my enemy must be my friend. And in this case, the enemy of the United States is not the friend of the left or the working class, not inside Iran. However, I can't underestimate the fact that since October 2023, with a very successful campaign, Iran's Islamic Republic has gained allies, not just amongst the left in Western countries, but also amongst the left in neighboring countries, in Greece, in Turkey. Partly it is the absence of any alternative, the failures of the rest of the left. the collapse of the left, the weakness of the left that has allowed this to happen. But there is no doubt that this time, actually, it's even worse than, say, I don't know, the Iran-Iraq war or the hostage crisis, where people were saying, oh, Iran is great because it's opposing imperialism. Just to explain on this, the Islamic Republic and its leader never uses the term imperialism because it's Marxist, right? So in opposing US, they have never, ever, or UK or any other country, they don't use the word imperialism. All they say is arrogant powers, right? So it just sums up what they think of even a historic concept such as, you know, imperialism. So to consider the Islamic Republic imperialist is just madness. I don't know how to put it.
What about, I guess, and we should probably end with this. I heard one actually on mainstream, you know, media here, one Iranian exile who's quite right wing, said that his hopes in the end of this would be a democratic secular state. Of course, we could say the same thing about Israel. Is this pie in the sky?
I think at this stage, yes, because who would organize such a state? And when you have contradictions in terms of the type of class differences that exist in Iran, who would be part of this democratic secular state? It won't be ordinary Iranians. It would be an elite state for a very artificial part of Iranian society. And the rest would be divided amongst those who might have and will have left-wing opinions and will not be allowed to exist, because the class divide will not allow them to exist. If they give them freedom, these people will definitely win. And so you wouldn't give them power, or remnants of religious groups that would want to turn the clock backwards. So I don't see that possibility. We are at a stage where the crisis is so harsh in many of the countries of the region, but in Iran in particular, where reform solutions, middle of the road solutions, soft solutions don't work. Mm-hmm. You have to think that either the working class can win, and at the moment there is limited chances of this, and create a true democracy, or you're going to have one form or another of class dictatorship with maybe more appearances of an elite parliament, but that wouldn't be democracy.
Well, with all of that, I want to thank you so much, Yasmin Mather, for helping us understand what's going on. And really, I knew that your analysis would help us cut through the noise on this crisis that has such far-reaching consequences. For the listeners, you can find Yasmin's writings regularly on Weekly Worker, but also in many other places. Thanks so much for joining us today, Yasmin.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And very good questions. You obviously knew so much. Thank you very much.
Thanks, and we'll definitely ask you to come back with us today. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Yasmin Mather. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcast. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
KPFK's transmission is failing. We need your help. KPFK's Mount Wilson transmitter is the heart of our broadcast signal. The aging units that comprise our transmission system require constant maintenance, repair for failing parts, and eventually we'll need to replace the transmitter entirely. Listeners across Southern California are already hearing the effect of these transmission issues.